If you're looking for a podcast to help you catch up with past episodes of the show Bridgerton so that you can be ready for the new season.
No. That's not us.
Yeah, because we haven't seen a single one.
No, although apparently I'm missing out on some attractiveness, but whatever.
Yeah, apparently there's a decent amount about Chicken Wow Wow in there, but this is not that podcast.
No.
This is, however, comedy.
Tragedy.
Marriage. Welcome to Comedy Tragedy Marriage, a podcast where a longtime married couple takes turns each episode selecting a movie, TV show, or documentary to watch. We watch it together, and then we sit down and discuss why we liked it, loved it, or loathed it, and share that discussion with you. I'm Stan the Movie Man. I review films at stanthemovieman.com. You can follow me on Twitter at MovieManStan. You can follow the podcast at CT Marriage. You can also follow me on various other micro-blogging sites, such as Blue Sky, Spoutable, and also Threads. On those sites, you can follow me at Stan the Movie Man. If you have a question you'd like to ask, or if you would like to suggest a movie for us to watch on and discuss on the show, you can do so simply by sending us an email, comedytragedymarriage@gmail.com. Or you can also just touch the link in the description of this episode and leave us a voice message. Joining me, as always, is my other half,
Maud the Quiet, Quiet Broad.
Oh.
Yeah.
Since when?
Nice.
It was your choice this week, and why don't you tell us what you selected?
My choice this week was, one that I had never seen before, except in little tiny snippets and bits and pieces from childhood on, and I don't know why I haven't seen the whole thing until now, but we watched the 1964 release, Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte. It's described as various things. It's called a horror film, and I guess it is, but for me, it's more like a psychological suspense kind of situation.
With a dash or two of horror.
It
is not it isn't the main focus of the movie.
It's not to me either. We'll talk about that. It was produced and directed by Robert Aldrich. It starred Bette Davis, Olivia de Havilland, Joseph Cotten, Agnes Moorehead, and Mary Astor. Mary Astor in her final film appearance, actually. It was adapted from a story by Henry Farrell, the screenplay written by Henry Farrell and Lucas Heller, from Farrell's unpublished short story, Whatever Happened to Cousin Charlotte. Okay, so a little bit of backstory here. The working title of the movie early on was the story title, Whatever Happened to Cousin Charlotte. Okay, in 1962, Bette Davis and Joan Crawford infamously starred in the psychobabble drama, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. And Bette Davis did not like the working title, Whatever Happened to Cousin Charlotte, because it sort of implied that this film was a sequel to Baby Jane, and it wasn't. The one didn't have anything to do with the other at all. Different characters, different universes, entirely.
Other than they both, the book that movie came from was written by the same guy.
Yes. It was another, and it was another Robert Aldrich production.
Mm-hmm.
The characters and the story were not related to each other.
No.
Content-wise. Cinematography by Joseph Biroc. Music by Frank Duvall. Now you can watch television shows from the 50s, 60s, and 70s and see the name Duvall on music credits ubiquitously. Frank Duvall did a lot of music for a lot of shows and films back in the day. It was distributed by 20th Century Fox. The budget was $2.2 million, and the box office, according to Wikipedia, is, it says $4 million, and in parentheses, rentals. So that was theater rentals at the time, I guess.
Yes.
Not ticket sales.
Now, it actually made a little over $4 million if you read further down in the reception part of the page.
It came out, it was released in December of 64, and it follows the story of an aging Southern belle who is appears to be the last of her immediate family line. She has one cousin apparently surviving, and that's it for the family, otherwise they're kaput. And she is being thrown off of her family land, basically. The county and the state are trying to build a road through there. They have issued her communications and summons and said, we're taking this land, we're tearing down your house, you got to get gone. The film opens with, does it open with the demolition scene, or does it open with the party?
It opens with the flashback to, like, okay, 1928.
It it opens, thank you, Stan.
Or 24.
27.
27.
Poor Charlotte, okay? She just, bless her. In 1927, as we see in a flashback, Charlotte's very creepy dad was rich and, you know, had more money than God. And in this parish in Louisiana where they live, the family's last name is Hollis, and they actually live in Hollis Town. So they were, you know, founding fathers and very, you know, pillars of the community, that kind of thing. Her dad is creepy, though, and he had thrown a party at the lavish Hollis estate, and we see creepy dad and a young Bruce Dern in the first of a couple of brief appearances that he makes in the film, discussing Charlotte. And Bruce Dern's character's name is John Mayhew. He is a married man, and he has been having a romance with Charlotte and is in love with her, and Charlotte's daddy is not having any of that, and he is haranguing him, the Bruce Dern character, John Mayhew, he is haranguing him and saying, I'm not having this. You will leave my beautiful flower of Southern womanhood daughter alone. Later in the party, we see this crowd of beautifully formally dressed people dancing and doing the Charleston and all of these things. And we see Charlotte in her beautiful party dress, but we don't see her face. And it's obviously because, you know, Bette Davis didn't look like a, you know, Southern young flower. At this point in her career, she was 56 years old. So I think that that was part of the reason behind not showing her face in the flashback scenes.
Well, and I think that's probably like a younger actress. And
in the body of the dress.
Yeah, there's a younger actress in the dress and they're just hiding her face.
Because it's not Bette Davis.
Right. And Bette Davis is just, you know, raising her voice, you know, raising the pitch of her voice so that she just sounds younger, and doing the dialogue voiceover.
We see her coming back from somewhere. She's been missed at the party for a bit, and, you know, cousins and people are wondering, you know, have y'all seen Charlotte? Well, Charlotte appears from wherever she's been, and her beautiful party dress is besmirched with blood all down the front. And it is discovered that John Mayhew has unceremoniously been kicked to the eternal curb in the sky. And it's Charlotte's creepy daddy just kind of whisks her away, and nothing ever comes of like whatever really happened to John Mayhew. So it is apparent that Charlotte has gone away for a bit of time and then come back to the family estate and lived under this cloud of mystery and suspicion when the actual murder was never solved. In another opening scene, a bunch of little boys are playing and passing by, you know, Crazy Charlotte's house, and she's a witch and the place is possessed and all. The one notable presence I see in this scene is the same young actor who played the character Dill in To Kill a Mockingbird. And this poor child, we will say he had an interesting face. He was a weird looking kid, and that's why he got cast in roles he got cast in. But forward a little bit, we see a construction crew, who apparently the actor George Kennedy is the foreman of, and, Charlotte chases them off of her family land, with a shotgun, and she's shooting warning shots, bouncing them off the, you know, body of the earth mover. And, so that's how the film opens. She writes a letter to her one last remaining relative, her cousin Miriam, who is portrayed by Olivia de Havilland. And Miriam is going to be the saving grace who comes and, you know, rescues Charlotte from this indignity of being kicked off her family land. Dr. Drew Bayless is a longtime family friend who is portrayed by Joseph Cotten, and he apparently has known Charlotte and her family forever and taken care of Charlotte when need has arisen. Agnes Moorehead is a scene stealer in this movie. She plays longtime maid, housekeeper, companion Velma Crether. And she is about as ugly and almost unrecognizable as can be. This is not her typical dignified looking persona that she's playing here. But she absolutely steals every scene she's in. She is disheveled and dirty looking, and she seems to be the one person out of this whole shooting match who actually seems to really know what's going on. She does not suffer fools. She does not suffer nonsense. And she is protective of her mistress, Charlotte, and apparently has worked for her for most of her life, is what it looks like. Miriam has been called in to save Charlotte, to save the family land and legacy and house. And it looks like that's what she's there to do until it doesn't. And since it's an old movie, I don't feel like I need to worry with spoilers or anything. In fact, we almost watched another film, which the title of which is Gaslight, and we may visit that at some point. But Miriam and Dr. Drew have cooked up an elaborate plan to, because everybody thinks Charlotte's crazy anyway. They have cooked up an elaborate plan to make Charlotte think she's crazy and to get Charlotte actually committed to the Nut House so that they can take control of the family money, the family estate funds, whatever, and whatever the state was going to give Charlotte for her home and land in order to, you know, run the road through and live high on the hog forever and ever. Amen. And some of the things that they do in order to gaslight Charlotte are pretty involved and pretty, I mean, it would have taken a lot to pull this off. It would have taken a lot just from a filming standpoint to pull off some of the things that they did. I'm thinking particularly of the scene in the music room where all the glass breaks and Charlotte is, you know, being tortured by these people who are supposedly her friends, but they're making her, their goal is to make her think that she is cracking up so that they can take control of her money and get her sent off to the macadamia ranch. So there's intrigue and there's a little bit of blood. The opening scenes where Bruce Dern's character is dispatched, he's dispatched with a meat cleaver.
A big old meat cleaver.
Big old honking meat cleaver. And we see a severed hand plopping down to the floor.
Well, we see a hand get severed.
Get severed.
Now, it isn't like in modern horror movies where it would be, it would look very real. This looked like somebody was cutting off a mannequin's hand. I mean, they made some effort, but yeah, it's not anything like what it would look like now.
Well, no, but for 1964, I mean, even you said that's pretty graphic.
For 1964.
Yes. You know, we see the stump of wood, the arm where the hand used to be.
Yes.
His head gets severed.
We don't see that.
We don't, but we know that it happened.
Yes, we're told that. And then later on, in an effort to drive Charlotte crazy, they get a mannequin, a headless mannequin, and stand it up at the door. And she opens the door, and there it is, wearing the tuxedo that he was wearing, or one that looks very much like it. And, you know, she, you know, loses her mind and goes crazy.
We also see his alleged severed head bouncing down the stairs.
Yes.
Where we learn that Dr. Drew has a friend in New Orleans who like works at a wax museum or something. Anyway, Miriam makes reference to your friend in New Orleans has remarkable talents because, you know, the dead head actually, you know, kind of had a waxy version of Bruce Dern's face on it.
Mm-hmm.
The film is considered something of a classic in American film, dumb. It received 7 Academy Award nominations, which, you know, at that time for a quote-unquote horror film was unheard of. Agnes Moorehead and Bette Davis both won Golden Globe Awards for their portrayals of their characters. I take that back. It was just Agnes Moorehead.
Yes.
Best Motion Picture Edgar Award, it won. It won a Laurel Award for Bette Davis for her portrayal of Charlotte.
It didn't win any Academy Awards, but it was nominated for 7.
It was nominated for 7, including Best Song for Hush Hush Sweet Charlotte, music by Frank Duvall and lyrics by Mac David. Now, a cover version was released by Patti Page, I'm thinking with, slightly altered lyric content. And we will bounce over to that page. Patti Page recording. Huh. When the song earned an Academy Award nomination for Best Song, apparently Bette Davis wanted to perform it. But Patti Page sang the song at the Academy Awards broadcast. And then it was released as a single after Days of the Waltzes and before You Can't Be True, Dear. This film is long and it's old, and we streamed it on Hoopla, which is a streaming service that is available to you as long as you have a current in good standing library account. So get your library cards, people, because we would have had to pay if we had watched it on Amazon Prime, but on Hoopla, it was free. So that's awesome. Speaking as a person who works in a library, I'm a big fan of, the many items and services that the local library has to offer. You had never seen this movie before, correct?
Correct.
In even little bits and
No,
pieces.
I don't think I had seen any of it, and I was thinking that I had, but I think I was confusing that with Baby
With Baby
Jane.
Jane. Okay, so give me your impressions now that I've sort of given a very slapdash, disjointed summary of Maud's impressions of Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte.
Well, it is surprisingly mean-spirited for a film from this time. I mean, there are some films of that period where they were going for social commentary, and they are equally, if not more, mean-spirited. But this is just, just like a sort of a Southern Gothic tale
That's
of.
what I thought too, Southern Gothic, but it may not be quite
It
Gothic enough
may
to
not
be
quite
considered Southern
qualify
Gothic.
right, but it's just this tale of this old Southern family that is reaching its end, and the old South still prevails because the only people of color we see are servants or musicians. But it's just this very sort of mean, angry, it's a slow boil kind of mean-spiritedness. At first, when her cousin arrives, you think she's there to help Charlotte, and she seems to be doing and saying everything that is sounds right. And then she has that weird interaction with the widow of
With
Charlotte's,
Jewel Mayhew.
Jewel Mayhew, played by Mary Astor, which at the time was like, well, that's kind of odd. But then you find out why she has that weird interaction.
Yeah, and actually, a pivotal but small role in this film was portrayed by Cecil Calloway, an English journalist who has been fascinated with the story for a very long time, comes across the pond.
Well, but he's not a journalist. He's actually an investigator for Lloyd's of London,
Oh.
because the life insurance policy on John Mayhew was never
Never,
filed,
yeah.
and it's
And why
still
would
sitting
that
there.
be?
And why is that?
Yeah. Yeah, you're right, you're right.
And he's pretending to be a journalist in order, Which seems like the exact opposite thing he would want to be, because the last thing that Charlotte wants to do is talk to journalists.
Yeah.
And it would seem like the last thing anybody in this little town would want to do is talk to a journalist, especially a British journalist.
Yeah, talk about not from around here.
But maybe people, you know, with his accent and all, maybe he was able to disarm them, because nobody, you know, treats him mean or anything. Except
And he
maybe
is quite
Velma.
The charming character.
He is.
And he seems like the one person who really wants to get at the truth.
He does. And I think if he had had more time and access, the way the movie ends might not have been what happened. But, you know, there's... but there's just, you know, this slow ramp up to where it gets meaner and meaner and meaner and meaner.
Yeah.
And these characters, especially Olivia de Havilland's Miriam, just gets just so, you know, cruel mm-hmm. toward Charlotte. And...
greed, baby.
Well, yes, it's yeah. greed, as we find out later. And there's the fact that, you know, the steps that she's willing to take in order to secure access to Charlotte's money, you know, leads to a death of a character that we really liked, and it's just this surprisingly sort of poisonous little movie that I really really liked.
Me too.
It's just so. Surprising that, you know, in many ways it is like Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, because that movie is just so much venom, and of course that was that benefited from the fact that Joan Crawford and Betty Davis hated each other.
Apparently that was the deal.
And Joan Crawford was supposed to play the Olivia de Havilland role. And had started shooting it.
Oh, really? I did not read that.
And then left the project, which there's no reason why it says she left. But then they brought in de Havilland to finish it.
Well, and Olivia de Havilland is cast against type here.
Oh yeah. Which I think
makes
it
that
even,
more effective.
Exactly. It makes it even...
Excuse
because,
me.
Bless you.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Olivia de Havilland is you know... why, Nelly, you're such a cool liar.
What a cool liar you are.
She was... you know, and she plays all of these sweet... At least the roles that I'm familiar with. There may have been some harder-edged ones, but... But all of the ones that I know her in, she's this kind, sweet, lovely person. And in this one, she starts out as this kind, sweet, lovely person that you
Come
expect
to
her to
rescue.
Be.
Come to the rescue, yeah.
And then she just turns into this shrew, this harpy, who's in it for her and will... you know, literally kill anyone that gets in her way.
Vicious.
Yeah. So, it's just this little sour bonbon that, you know, is a surprise. It's that little bite that like make set your teeth on edge.
It's like an unripe scupnin.
It's like, that's interesting. And I wasn't expecting it to be that. I was expecting an outside force to be the thing that was creating
the conflict.
The conflict and you know, trying to drive Charlotte crazy. And then it was in the house the whole time. The phone call, it's coming from inside the house.
It's coming from upstairs. You've got to leave.
So, you know, it's just this little surprising treat that I really, really enjoyed. While it certainly isn't scary, it is surprising. So
and there were some good moments of suspense. And
a surprise or two.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, you know, they really sell one aspect of the plot late in the film, where you think somebody has been shot, and then later on, turns out not.
Surprise! Yeah.
And then how it all, you know, how it all ends is just kind of perfect. I mean, this film does both a terrible job and a terrific job at foreshadowing. The whole thing with the cleaver is like, look at this cleaver. It's important.
Yeah.
It's going to come back here in a minute, and it does, but they make it so obvious. But there's another event that occurs early in the film that is repeated at the end of the film. It's like, oh, okay. Yeah, okay, I see what's going on here. So, yeah, it's just a really well-made old movie that, despite its age, has some really entertaining aspects to it. I really enjoyed it.
I'm glad you liked it.
It's a ton of fun.
And it was long, but...
Granted, yeah, it's 2 hours and 13 minutes. 133-minute running time.
Yeah, so... but neither one of us got up to go to the bathroom or make a sandwich or anything. I mean,
no.
We sat here until it was done.
We did, including the credits.
Yes.
So it was well worth the expenditure of time. It's a really, 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 it's surprising to discover a film like that made with those actors, that especially in that genre. It's just curious.
Not what you would have expected.
No.
From those actors, of course, this point.
You know, Baby Jane was made before this.
2 years before, in 1962.
So, that's a sort of a thrill. That is a thriller as well.
All of the principal characters in this film and in this story are of a certain age, too. Olivia de Havilland, I think, was the youngest principal cast member, and she was 48 years old.
Yeah.
When this was made. Agnes Moorehead, I think, was the oldest in the principal cast. Maybe Cecil Calloway was older, but I'm not sure.
Well, I'm sure he was.
But it's funny to realize that this movie and Bewitched both premiered in 1964. And of course, you know, Bewitched is a thing that Agnes Moorehead is hugely known for. But she had quite the film and stage career prior to,
mm-hmm.
Including, you know, Orson Welles films. Mm-hmm. She's in Citizen Kane.
She's Kane's mother.
She's in, I believe she was in The Magnificent Ambersons. And she is in the Orson Welles starred version of Jane Eyre, which I watched this past week. So she and Orson Welles had an association of sorts. So,
I wonder if she was in War of the Worlds, the radio play. I wonder if she was part of the Mercury Players.
I don't know, but God, what a voice. Would that not have been perfect casting?
Yeah.
Anyway, something we can look into. So how many things do you give this movie?
Oh, it's 5 stars, clearly. It is, it's a terrific movie. You should add it to your list of things to watch if you haven't already seen it, especially when you can get a library card and watch it for free on Hoopla.
I agree, and 5 crumbling Southern estates from me as well.
What else have you been watching, listening to, reading, whatever?
Well, as I said, I watched the Orson Welles and Joan Fontaine version of Jane Eyre this past week. Joan Fontaine being Olivia de Havilland's sister. They were not friends. There was a feud between them that went on for a very long time, apparently, and I don't know all the ins and outs of that, but I know that they were not friendly family. And I don't remember where I streamed it, but you can find it lots of places. I do remember. I streamed it on Hoopla.
Yeah.
Duh.
I think I remember because it shows you what you've watched recently.
Yeah.
I think I remember seeing it.
The reason that I watched it was because my partner in crime at the library read Jane Eyre for the first time within the last couple of weeks and just fell in love with the book. She just has gone on and on about how wonderful the book is, even though it's large and, you know, some archaic language in it, you know, written in the 1800s and all. But she loved the book, and I'm like, well, I'm not gonna read the book right away, but it did get me started on wanting to know how many different versions of the film Jane Eyre there are. There are lots, and I wanted to watch an old one. So I watched this one. It's from 1943. Orson Welles had a full head of hair and was just sort of a force of nature who blew into every scene he was in and sucked all the air out of the room. He was wonderful. So I watched that. I watched another movie. Let me get back into my handy-dandy little computer situation here. I watched a Hallmark movie the other night called The Memory Book. And it's the story of, I streamed it on Peacock, and it's the story of a young woman who is a photographer, and she primarily focuses on objects rather than doing portraiture or candid shots of people. And she's at a swap meet, and she finds an old scrapbook. And she is just completely taken with the scrapbook. It's filled with beautiful photographs from the 1970s of this couple who are obviously, you know, star-crossed lovers. They are totally in love with each other. And she finds the book, and the rest of the film is sort of a quest to find out who the book belonged to. Why did it end up at a swap meet when this obviously is something that someone put so much care and time and energy and love into assembling? How did it end up at a swap meet? And so the rest of the film is the quest to find out the answers to that. I really enjoyed it. I have put it on my list of little feel-good movies that I would like to revisit when I'm in the mood for something like that. So, and currently what I'm reading is the child classic, The Wind in the Willows, and I'm enjoying it. It's a charming little story populated by animals. We have the mole and the rat and the otter and the badger and the toad, who is, Mr. Toad is just quite the character. He is just completely off the rails. He's hilarious. And so that's what I'm reading and have watched and stuff. And we've got a little thing coming up in a few days that we can talk about more after you've talked about your stuff.
Okay. Well, Another service that you can use if you have a library card Canopy. Is called Canopy.
Sorry. Spoiler alert. Canopy!
And on there, I watched The Imposter. It is a documentary film from 2012. It is about the case of a French guy named Frédéric Bourdon, who...
Oh, I watched pieces of this with you.
Yes, and you fell asleep. Who pretended to be a missing Texas boy in an effort to get himself out of some trouble he was in Europe. He made a fake phone call to police while he was in Spain and said, there's an American boy here who has no ID and he's not saying much and we think he's been abused and could you send an officer? And the alleged American couple with the weird accent, which was him, on vacation in Spain, weren't there when the Spanish police showed up, and then took the teenager, who wasn't a teenager at the time, he was like 23 or 26, took him to a a youth home, and he was trying to figure out what to do, because apparently in Spain, if you do not have ID, they will take your fingerprints and put it in Interpol, and he knew he would be in trouble then, because he did have a record, a rather extensive record, because he had been pulling some shenanigans for a very long time. So he made some phone calls to the United States, including one to the Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And he gave a basic description of himself, and they said, well, that kind of sounds like Nicholas
Barclay.
He was pretending to be the police, and he asked police fax that to us, a picture, and he decided, close enough. So he said, yep, that's Nicholas Barclay. We've got him. Nicholas Barclay had been missing for 3 years from a small community in Texas, and when his family heard that he was in Spain, they were like, oh my gosh, he's alive? We figured after all this time, because he'd been missing 3 years, he must be dead, but great. And the FBI got involved, and his sister flew to Spain to talk to bring him home. And this very long and elaborate con began. And throughout the entirety of it, Bourdon knew that it would collapse just at any time, and then for the longest time it didn't. And so he figured, well, I can have a family that I've never had, even though he was significantly older than this child that he was pretending to be, and he didn't look anything like this child, but he was claiming that he was, significantly beaten by the sex trafficking ring that abducted him. And there were various things about his story that didn't sound right to the people investigating. He had, another thing was he had dark hair and he bleached it blonde, but after a while the dark hair starts to grow out again. There were just all kinds, and one little thing really tripped him up, and that was his ears. But I'll let you watch the documentary. It's called The Imposter. It's from 2012. It is available to watch for no charge on the service called Canopy if you have a library card. Otherwise, you can watch it. You can rent it from various services. I also watched the horror film Talk to Me. It was released in 2022. It is an Australian horror film. It's got a lot of people in it that you will not know who they are. But this film is about a group of Australian teenagers who have this hand that is allegedly the hand that belonged to a psychic medium or a Satan worshiper or something that is was severed from the body and is now encased in ceramic. And you hold the hand and you say, you light a candle and you say, "Talk to me," and you see something across from you that is a spirit coming to you from the other side. And then you say, "I let you in," and then somebody starts a timer and they have to pull the hand out of your hand within 90 seconds and blow out the candle. Otherwise, there's a chance that the spirit will remain attached to you. This teenage girl named Mia, her mom has died from an apparent either accidental or intentional overdose of sleeping pills. She's struggling to find her place in her friend group. She's sort of an outcast, but when she hears about this this hand thing and how it's sort of gone viral amongst her peers on social media, she offers to do it, and she, you know, it has this really powerful feeling associated with it, and she kind of becomes addicted to it, and all of her friends kind of become addicted to it, and then it turns into something very dark and sinister. This little tiny Australian movie made for like $4.5 million was a huge hit across the world. They're making a second one. I just hope it doesn't become what I refer to as the conjuringification of horror, as you know, they just churn them out, you know, like on an assembly line, and they all become very very generic and very, you know, so
formulaic.
Similar,
yeah,
formulaic, because Talk to Me is unique. It has a unique perspective. It does things you don't expect. And, you know, pretty much every movie that, not to pick on them, because sometimes they do deliver a banger, but a lot of the Blumhouse movies have this very predictable pattern to them. And they don't deliver any surprises, they don't deliver any suspense, and they deliver absolutely zero scares. There are some really tense and disturbing moments in Talk to Me. And I really, really enjoyed it. And I watched it on Canopy. So if you have the chance to see it, if you haven't already, please, by all means, do. Anything else?
No, except for we're going on
trip.
An excellent adventure.
Yes, we are. We are heading out, as you hear this, it'll be, we're heading out Thursday in a couple of days for a quick trip to Nashville, where we are going to see a bluegrass band called the Steel Drivers.
At the Ryman!
Yes, the original home of the Grand Ole Opry.
The mother church of country music, bless.
And when you first mentioned this, I was like, I have no idea who these people are. And I was like, I was ambivalent about it. And then I went to iTunes and couldn't find them at all. And I was even more ambivalent about it. And then I went to Spotify and looked them up, and there they were. And I listened to several of their songs on Spotify. I was like, oh, these guys are really good.
Yeah.
So
Chris Stapleton used to sing with the Steel Drivers back in the day before he went solo and exploded. I have wanted to see a show at the Ryman since forever. And I knew that there are a lot of cool things that come to the Ryman. I knew I wanted to see a music show. And so this came up, and the timing was right, and the tickets were reasonable. And I'm like, yeah, let's do this one. So, yes, we're going to have a little brief couple of nights in Nash, Vegas. We're going to see the thing at the place, and we're going to eat some food, and it's going to be a fun little quick jaunt.
And I assume we're going to Parnassus Books.
Well, most likely, yes. Speaking of Parnassus, if you are familiar with the store at all, they've been doing a series on Tuesdays, a series of videos every Tuesday called the Laydown Diaries. They're called Laydown Diaries because that is publisher book speak for laydown is what happens on Tuesday when new releases come out. That's the laydown. So they started doing the Laydown Diaries during the pandemic. I've been following the videos ever since then. And every week for years, I've been seeing Ann Patchett, who owns the bookstore. She's a famous, wonderful writer, one of my favorites. And her little terrier mix, Sparky. And Sparky has passed away. And so, but I never had the chance to meet Sparky. But on other trips to Parnassus, I've had the chance to meet some of the other shop dogs. It's a dog-friendly store if your dog is well-behaved and leashed. And there are shop dogs who are, you know, staff members there. And so it'll be our first trip to Parnassus post-Sparky. And, you know, if you're a dog person or a book person or just a person who has compassion, send out, you know, some love, light, and good juju to Ann Patchett and the people at Parnassus as they mourn the passing of the original shop dog, Sparky. So, but yeah, I would like to go there. I would love to take you to Nashville. It's this wonderful little deli where they have this delicious BLT that's, instead of bread, they put it between potato latkes, and it's like one of the most delicious things I've ever put in my mouth in my life. There are too many good meals to be had and never enough time. So, but we'll do the things. We may have to go to the mall and maybe hit the Container Store. I don't know. Just we party way too hard.
Oh, yeah. Boy, do we ever.
So, you know, little
have a container hangover.
Little jars and bags and boxes for, you know, needs you didn't even know you had.
Yes.
Right. But anyway, yeah, we're going to see the Steel Drivers, and we will give you the rundown on all of that next week.
All right. Well, thank you for listening to this edition of Comedy Tragedy Marriage. We appreciate it. Oh, by the way, next week, we're going to do Deadpool 2.
Oh, okay. Good to know.
Deadpool was such an overwhelmingly popular episode.
Was
with
it?
A grand total of 2 downloads.
Oh, quit.
So
it was a good movie. I liked it.
We'll do Deadpool 2. Thank you for joining us for this edition of Comedy Tragedy Marriage. We appreciate it. Please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you get podcasts, especially on Spotify. If you do that for me, that would be the most helpful. If you have a idea for a movie for us to watch and you want to tell us what it is and why you think we should watch it, Please send that to us at comedytragedymarriage@gmail.com. And who knows, you might just hear your suggestion as the next episode of Comedy Tragedy Marriage. I'm Stan the Movie Man. That's Maude the Movie Broad. Love you.
Love you.
And until next time.
Later.